Soul Talk is a podcast dedicated to making space for Latinx storytellers and content creators across all media to chat about their art, experiences, and culture. As a branch of the Soul Project, Soul Talk welcomes you to the Green Room.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Soul Talk. My name is Joey Reyes, and I am the producing assistant with the Soul Project. Today, I am joined by David Mendizabal, who is our associate artistic director, and Georgina Escobar, playwright. Both are currently collaborating at Intar Theater on Then They Forgot About the Rest, running through May 12th. And I'm going to pass this over to David really quick to introduce our topic for today.
Great. Thank you, Joey. So this is David. As Joey said, we're going to be chatting with Georgina Escobar today about her play, Then They Forgot About the Rest, which is billed as a femtasia yeah. and frontier futura funk piece with elements of noir. I love that. I love that. I did have the privilege and honor of directing the play, so I'm a little biased in my love for the play. But we're sort of here talking about the idea of Latinx futurity or Latinx futurism, whatever that sort of evokes. And I think one of the things that really got me thinking about this was an article that I passed off to Joey on CNN that talked about how Latina women are the future of the American economic market. And really, there were just some amazing articles. And I think we all know, you know, by 2060, 30% of the population under 35 will identify as Latinx, mm-hmm. and that the sort of booming numbers of Latinx people in this country, and yet we still see a dearth of our stories on TV, on film, on theater, on stages, you know. Mm-hmm. And this question of, you know, I guess, why is it important that Latinx people see themselves in the future? And that idea of what is that Latinx futurity. And so I think, you know, that was part of the reason why we wanted to bring you in, Georgina. Mm-hmm. A lot of your work centers around these post-apocalyptic worlds or this sort of multiverse in the future, this place that exists because of today, but in a world beyond. And so I guess that's sort of where we're going to jump off from. And so take
Great.
It away.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, first of all. Yeah, futurity. I mean, I don't know why it's happening, but it is. The only way that I can attach with what you just said about the economics aspect of it, actually, I read this book about present shock and digiphrenia, which inspired the Jones play that you, mm-hmm. that the movement company did a reading of. And I think it just started getting me to think about this idea that science fiction was created during a time or emerged. I mean, just one idea. Of a time when people were concerned about the future and things happening too fast, you know, men landing on the moon and microwave ovens and all these things. And so people were like, wow, it's like we're seeing the future right before our eyes and it's happening a little bit too fast and too soon and too close to each other, the events. And so it started creating this idea of like what else could happen and what terrible things could happen with that access to the future. And I think right now, which is what this author says of this book, Present Shock, is that we are in present shock. We're no longer necessarily looking at a future. We're like more like in the moment about everything that's happening right now because of social media, because of every access to information that is instant. And so we are actually in present shock. And there is no, I don't think yet, actual definition for that, which is why I don't necessarily identify with sci-fi, but I call it sci-fem or femtasia or futurism. I'm still trying to figure out what genre is, which is why I play with a lot of these, because I don't think we know where we're at yet. Mm-hmm. But I guess with that being said is that, the you know, putting Latinx bodies on stage, especially women, in these roles of dealing with the post-apocalyptic. And by post-apocalyptic, it really just means the same thing as Occupy Wall Street, right? It comes from the same need to see something end, mm-hmm. to see something change. And that is just the female existence right now, I think always. But I think now more than ever of being like, things have to change, like something. And the way to start thinking about change is to introduce an end to it, or a death to it. And so there's always a rebirth, and women function in that way of death and rebirth. And so I think that's why you start to see a lot of women, especially Latinx women, cover that topic right now.
I think one thing that came up for me too when I got to see the show last week, and I was actually re-listening to the previous recording of Soul Talk, and Lori Woolery, who directed El Huracán, mentioned the topic of epigenetics. So in particular with your show, Georgina, one thing that was sort of hovering around my head while watching the show is the idea of carrying trauma through life, whether it's our own personal but also inherited trauma. And, you know, the idea of ending and trying to, you know, that you're dealing with this theme of, like, what is worth forgetting in the show. And I was wondering if you can talk about, like, where that idea came from and, like, why you felt like that was something you wanted to address in the in the script.
Thank you. Yeah, it's so complex. I mean, but there's always a million entry points, I think, to any of my plays because I carry these journals that are filled and filled and filled with thoughts. So it's hard to pinpoint one, but exactly with what you're saying with epigenetics, correct? You know, my mother died when I was a young girl, and I was more or less raised by my grandmother, her mother. And I had to witness the act of forgetting, you know, every day of her, like, not wanting to talk about it, not wanting to access that memory, and then it just, like, betraying her and surfacing and what it would do and how it would wreak havoc on her. You know, she was such a solid woman that, like, she was fighting her own memory and wanting to get rid of it and not talk about it. And, you know, very Mexican kind of, you know, don't talk about it. And so I guess in writing this play, because it's something that I asked myself every day in dealing or in just loving my grandmother, of like, if she had the choice to remove the memory of my mother, if it meant taking away her pain, would she do it? And I unfortunately started asking that question too late, because now on top of it, she has Alzheimer's. So it's not even something I can actually ask her without her being very confused about the existence of my mother or that loss. So then that added a layer of like, oh my gosh, what is Alzheimer's? And is Alzheimer's the best thing that could have happened to my grandmother, you know? And I know that's a very controversial thing, but it just made me think, like, are we saying that Alzheimer's is this horrible, cruel illness, but is it actually a relief, you know, for them? We don't know. And you know, and then, of course, with the recent death of Maria Elena Fornés, and, like, just this idea of these women that have been, quote-unquote, forgotten, but do they know what being forgotten is if they're in this state of eternal forgetting? And so I think all of that was just what I was questioning when situating the play on top of that in a futuristic or a post-apocalyptic reality.
And for those of who haven't gotten a chance to see it, can you tell us a little bit more? We've sort of talked a little bit about what the play is about, but can you sum up the story?
Well, how dare you?
I have a blurb here I can also read, but I'd love for you to.
Sure. I guess to synthesize is good. It's in reality, it's a play that questions what is worth forgetting, and it's a mother who has lost her daughter, and she has the option to go to undergo this new treatment for a pill, or, you know, a treatment called Alleviate. Very Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, I know, but that's the question that is still unanswered. And juxtaposed with that, I threw in the idea, and it's happening at the same time, or perhaps inside Jeannie's head, is the reality of the rest. What is the rest? And in this world, it happens to be an advertising agency where the characters in the rest are also victims of this, like, forgetting through different ways, through different experiences, through being an immigrant and being induced to self-induced amnesia, or through having some sort of regression to block a traumatic portion of the past, or through having early onset, the characters are somehow afflicted. And so it sort of parallels this character going through the act of forgetting with what is the rest. And when you say, well, you know, if I forget one thing, I'm going to forget the rest, plug in what the rest means for you. And in this case, it just happens to be an advertising agency.
Full of some wacky people.
Exactly. Full of all the other parts of our brain that we often deny and ignore.
One of the things I think that, you know, this conversation is also bringing up is this relationship between the past and the future, and how they're so intrinsically intertwined, and we can't think about the future without actually thinking about the past. And one thing, you know, in our design conversations, in the meetings that we had with their incredible design team, one of the things that really came up was this idea of how do we imagine a world, post-apocalyptic world, with where the big sink has happened, where New York and Florida and California have sunk and everyone has now fled to the Southwest, you know, and there's this 1950s Big Chill fridge on stage and, you know, in the costumes, like Asa Benali, our costume designer, really sort of pulled out these almost 80s kind of vibe to it. And there's a lot of other moments in which technology as we understand it in the play actually doesn't look like this sort of like high tech, super technologically advanced, but actually kind of goes back to something in its original form, sort of these original kind of old school, like almost an old school sci-fi aesthetic. And one thing that you talked about when we were designing was this idea of like retro futura.
Yes.
And I'd love to hear more about that and like what the relationship that the past has to the future in terms of an aesthetic.
I mean, I think honestly it's a Gen Xer thing. We are caught, I'm an 80s kid, you know, I was born in 1980. So it's like we were caught in that world where video games were still very, very early. And then you still were playing tag and, you know, hide and go seek outside and spend most of your day outside. And so I think a lot of writers and artists in my generation specifically are really tied to that idea of being the connector of both worlds, of being that sort of entity that actually did navigate these two worlds of the digital and the social media and, you know, and the internet and stuff, and also didn't have it. Like, I didn't have, you know, email until I was in college, you know? And so like those kinds of things that sort of are very real and tangible to Gen Xers, I really think it's an aesthetic that has to do with the generation, right? Because I've seen it, obviously it's showing up everywhere. And when I look at something and I'm like, oh my God, that's so retro futura. And I see the age group. I mean, we're all in that same. So I'm like, okay, we're guilty of it. And I think, but I think it's that idea, it's that nostalgia. And nostalgia has a very powerful, you know, effect in our brain. And, you know, with the existentialists did it, you know, for so long. Like the nostalgic, the preying on something that makes us want to return to a past actually makes us question either whether there is a future or there isn't. Whether you're fatalistic or not, that's your own thing. But, you know, the retrofutura aesthetic to me triggers visually and tangibly what that nostalgia and what being that Gen Xer means of seeing something just disappear from common culture, but moving towards it again, this sort of cyclical thing that what we're mourning is not really going to go away. And it just, to me, it's just delicious, you know? I mean, just seeing objects from my childhood in places that are supposed to be futuristic, it's just delicious.
I get a kick out of it when I go to like a store. Like I was at Urban Outfitters the other day and all of a sudden I looked over and there was like Tamagotchi and I was like, what? Like what? Like why?
Yeah.
Do you know? But yeah, there is something about that nostalgia and that you see it, the cyclical nature, I think, is something that you said. You see it happening in style and
fashion,
in technology. And it's like at a certain point, I guess that question is like once we've imagined something so far ahead, do we almost push so far that we have to go backwards?
Right.
Do you know? Like is it almost like we've pushed to the extremes of the imagination of what is possible, that the counterpoint is necessary?
Right.
Do you know that the opposite is actually what's necessary and something more in the digital frame is actually going to be something that we're going to be like, yes, that is the new thing right now.
Right.
Which I just think there's a couple of moments and decisions that we made in the play that just they tickle me. And I guess that is true. It's like it is that nostalgia about it that I wonder what it means for someone in our generation versus a younger generation, which I would say is really responding strongly to the work.
The younger generations usually do. That's very it's kind of scary and beautiful because it's impressive how engaged they are and how much they understand and how moved it's been impressive and consistent, which says something beyond anything that I have any grasp on currently. But also, when it comes to the retrofutura, it also plays on the literary, I guess, for me, or at least in framing the play or situating some of the language and stuff. Because I was reading, I think I told you, on the Wabasabi aesthetic, and just this idea of, like, the imperfect, the incomplete, you know, the impermanent, and, like, sort of this rustic and minimalistic kind of idea, and then completely pushing that towards the complete opposite, you know, the overindulgent and the big. And so, like, playing with these two aesthetics to sort of try to find a new one is just, it's kind of the alchemy. It's the only reason for me that to do theater, is like to try to find the alchemy. And sometimes it's going to blow up in your face, you know, that's the whole point. But at one point, you perhaps might discover something that wasn't there before. Mm. And so for a lot of the things, I actually don't know what is happening until the young audiences tell me.
Mm. It's also so funny because I think for some audiences, there is nostalgia, a sort of longing of the past. And for some audiences, they've never seen it. They have no idea. So to them, it is the future.
Right.
And we're like, what? That is the past. And that tension and that relationship, I think, is just so delicious and exciting to watch in the audience.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like that's a great segue. I wanted to ask you, Georgina, I know we were talking about it a little before we started recording too. What has the response been that you've been receiving in regards to this show? And you don't necessarily have to go into details of, like, positivity and negativity, but, like, generally in this conversation of you're telling the story of Latinx futurity in this very, like, specific lens, how's that being received so far?
I think it, like everything in art, it's going to take some time to process that for me, but I think overall it's just been a positive and a response based on abundance and not scarcity. Like, I haven't received any, or I haven't heard anything being about, like, this is lacking in something, but rather, like, if it's quote-unquote negative, it's more about their entryway and their entry point. And, you know, sometimes there's things I question about who goes see plays and why, and why do they want from it? And mm-hmm. So I was saying earlier, why is it that female characters are accused of ranting and male characters aren't? And, like, you know, these kinds of things that are just part of the whole game. But overall, what I've been walking away with, you know, most impressively for this piece, for some reason, non-binary or gender non-conforming audience members have been very vocal about and immigrants and coming out and saying, I don't feel like I'm alone. Like, you made me feel like I'm not alone. Mm-hmm. And that could mean many things, right? I mean, I think it's just knowing that there's these crazy, wacky characters and the rest, and, like, they can all coexist, you know, and they can have silly sense of humor, and they could all coexist. And, you know, and sort of these things that, for some reason, has been the words that I've heard, cathartic, and made them feel less alone and made them feel vulnerable and has stayed with them. So that has been the response, whatever that means. It's doing something. Again, like I was saying earlier, we can't really know what it is because I feel like it is new, so we're trying to understand it. Mm-hmm. But in that trying to understand it, it's been from a place of abundance. So to me, that's a good thing because mm-hmm. it's causing people to have conversations about, you know, the piece and with each other and what was it about, and not, like, be angry or like, oh, your costumes were great, which it's great. They are. Mm-hmm. But, you know.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying witnessing this surge of obviously people having more opportunity to tell different stories that are not, you know, in the traditional sense, you know, the Arthur Millers and the Tennessee Williams and the realism and all of that, you know, in a lot of the conversations I've been having in the last few months, especially in regards to Latinidad and Latinx storytelling, is ideas of magic realism or reimagination. You know, and speaking upon, of course, like trauma stories too, telling the stories of what people are going through at the border and whatnot, but also, like, looking towards the future, or, like, even just entering a world of, like, a comic book storyline too. Let's see, what am I trying to say here? or even, you know, with Movement Theater Company, you all were just nominated for What to Send Up for Drama Desk, for What to Send Up When It Goes Down, for a special theatrical experience.
Unique.
And I think, I just think it's interesting, like, in regards to those standards and labels or whoever is, like, gatekeeping those. But it really was, when I got the chance to see that in particular, that the reference to it was that it was a ritual. And, you know, this idea of, for people of color, trans and gender nonconforming folks, people who are now being able to step into this spotlight and claim their own stories and not have it be told for them by other people and call it what they need to call it. But allowing, you know, the people who have been part of the majority be invited into it, but understanding and respecting that that space has been curated specifically of, by, and for these people. And I feel like your play has also, like, you know, you said in particular to gender nonconforming folks, like, that they resonated with something in it, that it wasn't necessarily focusing particularly on that experience. Correct. But there was something in it that there's so much going on within the mind of the show that it felt really reflective in that sense.
I think what it is, I mean, maybe it, I think it's the fact that it doesn't ask you to have an opinion about it. Like, it's not telling you how to feel about the characters. It's not even telling you what character to follow or who to care for. Or, like, it's not allowing you to hinge on these old ideas of, like, you know, our social spaces and, like, how we connect with each other socially, because that's a lot of the problem. And I try to write from a place of, like, nature and understanding nature, right? Because that's the big problem, is that we're not listening to nature. And you don't go up, you know, you don't go to a park and try to explain your experience at the park and say, you know, well, the park is doing this to me, you know, and you don't have those experiences. But we somehow do that in theater, and we shouldn't. And it should feel as natural as walking into a place that is in nature, so that we understand also how to listen to nature and how to have that experience with it, and hope to move into a different sphere of understanding. And that basic thing, I think, is the reason why immigrants and gender nonconforming and non-binary folks feel that connection, because it's like, you're not asking me to have an opinion or be there, or, like, because we are asked that all the time. We are asked to check boxes all the time. And so when we're not experiencing that, and we're literally just there, whether it's a ritual based play or it's a play that's just throwing ideas at you 1,000 a minute and it's asking you to be a thinker for an hour, it allows them to feel less alone, because we're not asking them for anything.
Well, I think there's a different kind of engagement of the audience that's asked of, and you can see it when you're watching, you know, in the show is at INTAR, it's a very we made the space even smaller. Our set designers, Justin and Christopher Swader, you know, we're inside of this bunker with everyone, and the audience is on stage and around, and so you can see people, and I feel like you can see the folks who are willing to engage in the unknown and those that are fighting it. And I think what we've always talked about in doing the play is that in a lot of ways it is an assault of ideas and questions. And I think what I've heard a lot from friends of mine and folks who've come to see the show is that there is both, you both completely understand and have no clue at the same time. And, like, is that not how memory works? And I think that was something when you posed that early on in the rehearsal process, is like, how can I claim to understand something that we still as a society do not fully understand how it works, how memory functions and forgetting functions, and these sort of big questions that are going on. And so this idea that it is posing questions and there is a linearity to the story, I think there absolutely is sort of a this happens and this happens and this happens, you know, but I think simultaneously you're asking the audience to engage with sensorially differently. You know, it's more of a visceral reaction to what did stick with you, what didn't. And I think part of what we were trying to do is not actually give the audience any time inside of the play to stop and think, you know, that this is not sort of a leisurely experience where you can stop and sort of be like, what was that about? What was that about? But really just, like, take in the whole 80-minute experience, and afterwards, like, what stuck with you? What was there? And I found in some of the conversations I've had with people that they're like, at first I didn't understand, but as I kept unpacking images and as I kept realizing and putting things together, I made this story for myself that is that to me, as you know, as the director, my response has been yes and
right.
to all of the reactions to the piece. It is that and that and that. And I think there's something about that that is challenges the field and the aesthetic and structure and form in a way that we're not seeing, especially not seeing amongst our, you know, Latinx artists, if we're seeing anything amongst our Latinx artists, because they're not being produced. You know, right. And so I think there's something so refreshing and exciting about the piece that is challenging all that we think we understand the possibility of theater. And I think for some people who are willing to go on that journey, they are receiving it a little bit more, and others not as much.
Well, I mean, that's the thing about live theater. I mean, quote unquote, well-crafted story, the linear, that kind of, you know, structure that creates a psychological or an emotional impact, you know, is being done very well on television, which is great, and I love it. I'm a Netflix fan, you know, but at the theater, I mean, we're at that place where we go, what is this doing? What are we craving? And why is this happening in this moment with the people that we are sharing the space with? And we can, you know, see the person in the side falling asleep and that kind of thing. Like, but it's unique. Like, nobody's taking offense. I mean, really, nobody's taking offense to it, because it's really just saying, I'm here watching somebody have an experience that I'm also having, and I'm having a completely different experience. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. And what better to remember that as human beings, that it's okay to have a different experience, to have a different feeling, to walk away knowing something different, you know, like this idea in the craft of having like this expert, you know, command. It's like, why do we want to be experts at art? You know, like, this is not the place where you want expertise, because it'll fail to be imaginative. It'll mm-hmm. fail to be anything that's transcendental. And so I think that's why a lot of us are looking for some, you know, those the semiotic language and all those things that we know, David, like, there's so many details in this piece and so much thought went to it that, like, everything matters. That's why it's percolating. Mm-hmm. That's why people are leaving and going, oh my God, I just thought about this. It was not accidental. This was all, you know, we tried as much as we could to be deliberate. So that kind of percolating feeling is very common, I think, I find in my work. And another thing that people have been saying about it is that it makes them think of their own memories. Mm-hmm. They go to their own memory bank. And that's cool, you know, mm-hmm. that, like, if you go to my play and you spend the 80 minutes daydreaming, I've done my job, because it's about engaging your better instrument, not mine. I'm not there to teach you about my instrument. It's about your what you do with your body and with yourself, experiencing it with other people.
Mm-hmm. I will say, too, and particularly where I was sitting, I happened to be sitting right on an edge where there were a lot of exits and entrances happening, and sometimes they were really frantic and really exciting. But it was also really great in the way that the show is set up in the space, where there are people on the sides and people sort of watching on all three sides, being able to see other audience members' reactions. And try to, like, they become part of the show we all become part of the show for each other, and trying to have fun with, like, trying to interpret, like, how is this person receiving this in this moment? Mm-hmm. But also going along the journey of this physical manifestation of what it might look like to traverse through your memories and confront them mm-hmm. and face them head on. And how are you going to get through that, whether it's going to, like, push forward to feel like you've had some closure with it, mm-hmm. or is it something that you need to continue to sit with? So yes, I really appreciated being able to witness that journey and, like, have it physically in front of me rather than me having to just daydream in my own head and my regular everyday life. But be carried through it and then leave with questions, and sitting, you know, on the hour commute home on the train, like, picturing myself in that situation.
Like, wow, cool.
Yeah.
The cast is really, I mean, they're doing so much in such little time. It's incredible. It's like the Olympics. It's like, you know, word and physical Olympics for them. And they've really taken it to the next level.
One of the things I'd love for you to talk about, because you mentioned in your playwright's note, in the program that you get at INTAR when you go and see the show, you mentioned that the play is part of a bigger universe, the Wayfoot universe. And for those who attended the Latinx Theater Commons Carnival the first year, they saw the play Sweep, which is part one of a three-part Wayfoot trilogy. Yeah. And I'd love for you to talk about that, like more along the lines of how does this play, which in production we did not do the prologue and the epilogue, which unites it into the universe. But talk more about like the Wayfoot universe and this idea, I think, as a writer, too, of, you know, we build worlds when we build plays. And here you are building universes.
Well, thank you. I was just talking about this last night and I was like, oops, because it is a trilogy, but I think the trilogy was kind of tacked onto it by somebody, like by outside forces being like, oh, it's part of a series. But actually, the Wayfoot universe is much larger than that. It's just it happens to be that there's three plays that I know for sure carry this through line. But the Wayfoot has been in so many of my things, of my writings, of my sketches, my art, you know. And so it's this mysterious, you know, entity that is neither male nor female, not gendered. I mean, it's just collecting characters from different stories to tell their bigger story about, and it's all about human evolution and like the what I call full activation, which is all like about it's another what if, right? If we had the tools to literally push a button and half of humanity would like reach its highest potential as human beings, kind, generous, loving, like we've moved past all the violence, all that stuff, but the other half had to die, would you do it? And it's this kind of thing of like balancing ultimate evolution. And so the Wayfoot carries that what if. And because of that, because I haven't been able to situate him in his or their or she, her story, they're moving through my plays, collecting characters. And the way that I've kind of manipulated that in the plays is I'm creating sort of a Rubik's Cube where, for example, in Sweep, the Wayfoot is this woven in through line, but that is also removable. Mm. You can also literally detach it. The sweep that you saw in Carnival does not have the Wayfoot. Mm. The sweep that you saw in Aurora did have the Wayfoot. So it's also a detachable piece that you can plug in or have the standalone sweep. And then if you're out about the rest, you can have the bookends. So I didn't do the Wayfoot as a through line in this. I did it as a bookend. And so in this one, you can bookend the prologue and the epilogue, or you can have it as a standalone piece. And then the third one, The Shepherds of Arcadia, which is just in its very initial bottling cloud faces. I mean, I have to go through like 13 notebooks and filter out stuff. That's the one where we really see the full aspect of this full activation and where we really get to question our own ideas of what is good and what is bad, what is good, what is evil, that kind of idea of who is right, who is wrong, that has filtered everything in our society and hopefully ultimately just look to set a little bomb on the, foothills of patriarchy and just, you know, see what happens. But like, that's the goal. But that's why I don't think it's a trilogy. I really think it's a whole, I mean, if the goal ultimately, and it is to dismantle the patriarchy, it's not a trilogy. Mm. It's my entire life's work. So it's like, you know what I mean? So, but as far as the Wayfoot, yes, they exist in this trilogy. Hopefully one day, if we see them in rap with the through line, it will make complete sense.
Yeah.
Or somebody will do it. Somebody brave will do the 8-hour show and be like, it still doesn't make sense. And that's okay. But I don't know yet.
That's great. I love it. I love the idea that it's like it either will or it won't, but is that not the risk of theater that we're all doing?
Right.
And making. Great. As we're looking, you know, to sort of wind up this episode, mm-hmm. I'd love to go back to this initial question. And I think there's been so much inside of this conversation that has answered it. And there's so many obvious answers, but I'd love to know for you, like, why do you think that it's important that Latinx people see ourselves in the future?
The same. Okay, so we've been trying so hard in our first sort of stage of becoming as part of just the art makers in this country to define our past or to remember our past. And I think that was a huge phase of our of our gran veteranos, you know, and their work, and really making sure to remind us all where we came from, who we are, what we're doing. And then we did see, you know, the also our veteranos and our current practitioners talking about the present and really, you know, moving us politically and socially and like being on the activist front. And then there's a different layer, I think, of that, and that's the future, and it's just as important. I can't do this without my veteranos. I can't do this without my other Latinx cohort. Like, I can't do it in the void. But I think it, playing in tandem with each other and with the history that we have of, like, our veteranos, our current practitioners in the future, you know, we're moving and we're telling them, all of us, we can create stories in all of those spectrums, and they're still right. But right now, especially right now, let's move us into the future so that it doesn't shock people when it starts to actually happen, when their boss happens to be Latino, or when, you know, their superior happens to be a gay Latina woman, that they're not like freaking out or having like a mini embolia, you know, in their brain, like, oh my God, like, so that they can be like, oh yeah, I've seen it. It's common. Like, it's part of, you know, it's the same reason why kids nowadays, like, my little nieces and nephews have complete understanding of me being gay without like even questioning it, but their parents were like, I don't know how to talk to them about it.
Yeah.
And I was like, you don't have to, because they've seen it. They're seeing it. Representation matters, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. So, yeah.
That's exciting. It makes me think, you know, I was reading an article also that was specifically about the idea of Latinx, you know, which is this relatively new phrase and identity that's being brought out. And Ed Morales, who has a book called Latinx, The New Force in American Politics and Culture, says Latinx is a fascinating identity because it is futurist. It points to the future of how society could evolve. And like, there was something about that that sort of made sense. It is this idea. Like, I love that you said you talked about our becoming and our sort of, you know, the evolution of the past and the present. And as we look forward the future, and as we sort of really begin to codify this idea of a Latinx identity, that in itself is futurist, that in itself does imagine a world that did not exist prior, a world of intersectionality, a world of, you know, layers and complexity that grows out of an evolution of people.
It's been one of the first, I mean, and you know this, you know my like aversion to the Latinx only from a Spanish standpoint, so it has nothing to do, because, and let me clarify, like I can't identify like as a Latinx, because I identify Latinx as a movement, and it's constantly fluid, and it's constantly moving around inside you, out of you, everything, and that's beautiful, and I identify all of my Latinx cohort as such. But I'm a Mexicana, you know what I mean? Soy una vieja Mexicana. Like, I'm pretty, like, sure. But that's okay. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, it's not about me. It's about the movement. And when it's the first time that I've seen, like, an identity or whatever that actually has the complete bio and chemical and societal movement in it that makes it this being, this entity, this organic becoming. And to me, that is revolutionary, and that is new. And that's why I'm like, you know, applause to that. Like, screw the linguistics of it. I have my issues with it linguistically, but not with the actual meaning of it and the movement of it.
I think it's just speaking more to how, you know, the statistics of what the world looks like, you know, 30, 40 years from now, and really highlighting the fact that our society here in the U.S. is not as black and white as a lot of people, you know, want to think of it. It's a lot more fluid, and even, you know, with the term itself being inclusive to address, you know, people who might be trans and gender nonconforming, non-binary, and still want to like have that power within their identity and say, yes, I am a Latin person. And here's this beautiful term here that's, you know, we're dealing with very gendered language too, that, that essentially is something that was brought over from Spain and is a product of colonization. And so it's just like, I think really exciting again to have this sort of reformation of language and identity that is then pouring out more and more into the future as we go further along.
And hopefully we'll have something that encapsulates the Americas, because I think the mm-hmm. sisterhood of the Americas is key, mm-hmm. key to, mm-hmm. again, my master plan of the patriarchy. Mm-hmm. But the sisterhood of the Americas is tremendous. And I think if we're moving the Latinx to be more inclusive, hopefully we'll have a term for American that actually means all of us, mm-hmm. because absolutely. It is the Americas.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that sounds like a great place to wrap us up on. Yes. A great note. One final plug, Then They Forgot About the Rest is playing through May 12th at Intar Theater on 500 West 52nd Street on the fourth floor. You can purchase your tickets at www.intartheater.org. That's theater with an R-E. Anything else that we want to plug, Joey?
I just want to shout out all the season announcements that are coming from the new artistic directors that are popping up all over the place. You know, Woolly Mammoth just announced with Maria Goyanes their season. And, you know, we already had the season announcement from Stephanie Ibarra at Baltimore Center Stage. Hana Sharif and OSF just announced as well just the other day. It's a really exciting time. Yeah. And looking forward to trying to travel to all these places to see everything.
Absolutely.
Here we go.
Absolutely. I'm excited to see more of the New York announcements as well, and mm-hmm. see if we can see any more of our Latinx stories on stages here, or we'll just be doing a lot of traveling. Wonderful. Thank you, Georgina, for joining
us.
Thank you so much.
Joey.
This was a lovely conversation. And stay tuned for Soul Talk episode 3, 4, 5, 6, all of them. It's been lovely chatting with y'all.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you all for joining us for today's episode. Make sure you follow Soul Project on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. On Instagram and Twitter, we are at Soul Project NYC and The Soul Project on Facebook. Our website is www.soulproject.org.